WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Army Reserve PFC Lindy England, infamous for her appearance in photos holding a leash with an Iraqi prisoner on the other end, was brought before a military judge who threw out her guilty plea and declared a mistrial. A year ago last week, on 60 Minutes 2 and in the New Yorker magazine, Americans first confronted what has come to be called the horrors at Abu Ghraib. And ever since, the American Civil Liberties Union has worked to keep the story of prisoner abuse on the front page. It's hard to put new spins on what amounts to the same dismal story in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. But the ACLU has been helped by a Freedom of Information Act request filed long before the Abu Ghraib pictures went public. When that request was ignored, the ACLU sued, resulting in waves of fresh documents detailing abuses. Emily Whitfield is the ACLU's media relations director. She says ACLU lawyers scrutinize every document for potential news stories.
The court has ordered the government to deliver 8,000 pages to us every 2 weeks. That's a lot of material. Our process has been, we want as many readers out there and people in the media to pick up this material and tell the public about it. So we have our lawyers on staff analyze the material and find what we think are the most newsworthy and unfortunately sometimes the most gruesome parts of it about abuses to prisoners, fingers being poked into their wounds, having their hair ripped, having their genitals grabbed. Unfortunately, that's the kind of thing that does grab people's attention, and in this instance, it should.
So when you have every 2 weeks 8,000 pages to go through, you look for headlines.
We do look for headlines, and then what we do is we analyze it and we make an index on our website so that people can easily click on the sections that we're talking about. And I can't tell you how many reporters have called up and said, thank you for doing this. This is incredible. I can't believe the kind of material that you're getting. And so from the time we started getting material in October 2004 until very recently, Brooke, that was working very well for us.
So it used to work really well for you. What's happened since then?
Well, what changed in March was that the Army probably figured out what we were doing and realized that we were making headlines in this way and the issue was staying before the public. And that's something that clearly they were not happy about. They've been ordered by the court to give the documents to us first so that we can take a look at them. So they started, instead of releasing the material to the ACLU and letting us do our thing, they started giving the material directly to certain select reporters. And at times of the day and times of the week when it made it very difficult for anyone to do a decent story.
You mean the classic document dump late on Fridays when people are getting ready to go on vacation?
That's right. I had one New York Times reporter call me up at 3 o'clock and say, I've got to haul over to the Pentagon on the metro and pick up a huge heavy box of documents, then I've got to go through it. Who knows when he's going to be able to write his story? I have to say, reporters have nonetheless done a very good job of also finding those nuggets of salient information. But it just makes it a lot harder for us to present it to the press and to the public. And it's been clearly deliberate on the Army's part.
So that's how the Pentagon may try to sidestep the ACLU. How about in dealing with other reporters?
Well, I know of one case. I talked to reporter Seth Hetina with AP in San Diego recently. He covers the Navy SEALs down there. And he had been Googling on the web for looking for information about the Navy SEALs, and he came across one of these photo sharing sites called smugmug.com. And on it were photos of Navy SEALs sitting on detainees who had been handcuffed and doing things that looked to be abusive and certainly raised questions about what was going on. He wrote a story about those photos, and he published those photos. The Navy SEALs' families turned around and sued him for distress and for damages. And not only that, but then the Navy itself patented the photos and turned around and sued him for patent violation for publishing the photos.
Ex post facto?
Yes.
How did that suit go?
Well, I think that's still ongoing. And what Seth told me was that his lawyers were planning to file what they call a slap suit, which is a suit alleging that the government was using the lawsuit in a retaliatory fashion. They weren't seeking justice. They were seeking to shut him up.
While the ACLU has been requesting documents from the Pentagon, you've also been requesting photographs. Is that because you think that photographs are simply part of the record or that they help make stories stickier? The Abu Ghraib story obviously stuck in the minds of Americans because those pictures were so gruesome.
Well, we do think it's crucial to get photos for that very reason, Brooke, because the Abu Ghraib photos really galvanized the public around this issue, and it made them understand in a way that no amount of paper documents ever would what exactly was going on over there. We know these photos exist. We know these videotapes exist. The Army certainly knows it, and they are desperate not to have them released. I can tell you how desperate the Army recently argued to the court in trying to resist releasing these photos, that to release photos of prisoners and videotapes of prisoners would violate the prisoners' Geneva Convention rights, which it's just so ironic. It's hard to believe. It's so shameless because, of course, these are photos that the soldiers themselves took of the abuses, which themselves are violations of Geneva Convention rights. And we've even said to the Army, look, if you want to cover people's faces so that they're not shown, go ahead and do that. But let's see the photos.
And there's also a story about a video that the government said it wouldn't be able to release.
Ramadi Madness. This was back in March, and they gave us a bunch of documents that included a description of Ramadi Madness, a homemade CD made by GIs, which included, according to the description, incidents of GIs kicking people, of hitting a prisoner in the head with a rifle butt who was handcuffed. In the documents that they described, they said they couldn't investigate it further because they couldn't get their hands on the CD, and that if they were to ask anybody for the CD, it would almost certainly be destroyed, and so they weren't even going to bother. Well, within about 6 hours of when we put out these documents that we got, the Palm Beach Post got a hold of the CD. The visuals from that weren't particularly compelling because they were very blurry, they were very dark, but just when you saw the heightened interest in that, and all of a sudden our phones are ringing off the hook, you know that the media out there, especially the broadcast media, is keenly interested in any visuals. And I can't tell you how many invitations to lunch I get and how many phone calls I get from people saying, you know, once you get those videotapes and those photos, I'd really, really like to see them. And what I tell everybody is, I'd like the world to see them.
Emily, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Emily Whitfield is the Media Relations Director for the ACLU.
Last week, the Pentagon released more than 700 photos taken at Dover Air Force Base and other military facilities depicting honor guard ceremonies for soldiers killed in war. Taken by official military photographers, there's nothing terribly shocking in these images, just solemn processions of flag-draped coffins. But for the public, they were startlingly unfamiliar. The Pentagon bans media from Dover, and it wasn't until University of Delaware professor Ralph Begleiter sued that the Pentagon granted his FOIA request for the photos. Begleiter took his cue from journalist Russ Kick, who last year also won access to Dover Pictures through a FOIA request. Begleiter says this latest release of photos should make it harder for the government to, quote, hide the human cost of the war from the American people. But it will be up to the people to keep filing those requests. As we just heard, ACLU lawyers have secured reams of documents through FOIA, but as Russ Kick told us last year, ordinary citizens can use FOIA just as effectively. It just takes persistence and time.
This is something that truly anybody in the country or anybody in the world can do. All you have to do really is send a letter to the FOIA office of the agency that you're interested in and tell them what you want. You don't even need to be a citizen, actually.
Do you believe that FOIA is grossly underutilized by American media?
Oh, definitely. There's been studies that have been done about who is using the FOIA, and it turns out that the media makes up just a tiny fraction of all the requests. It was something along the lines of 10%.
Do you have any evidence to suggest that government agencies intentionally make the process as cumbersome and unrewarding as possible to discourage reporters who, after all, are on deadline from getting involved in the process to begin with?
Oh, definitely. If you remember the strategy game Othello, the slogan for that is, a minute to learn, a lifetime to master. And that's pretty much the way it is with FOIA, because you can learn how to make a request in a minute, but dealing with the stonewalling, the excessive fees, and just sometimes outright lies, that's what takes a long time to learn how to work with.
Well, FOIA master, bestow on us your your wisdom.
Well, one thing is, under FOIA, you have one appeal when you're denied. Always use it, because there are these various numbered exemptions having to do with national security or personal privacy. They have to name specifically at least one of those. If they don't, which sometimes happens, then you've really got a great case for an appeal. But even if they do name them, you know, you try to think like a lawyer and figure out why they're wrong to have used that exemption. Most of the time I've found the appeals don't work, but it's still important to try. And another thing is, one of the tactics that the CIA is using, and they're one of the most popular agencies that get FOIAs, they'll automatically send you a letter back saying that you have to agree to pay at least $150 for each request before they'll even start processing. And the reason this is something of a trick is because they're hoping, of course, that most people will just say, well, forget it. You know, I can't afford that. The way I get around that is when I send any request into the CIA, I automatically tell them in the letter that, yes, I agree to pay up to $150 for this request. And so far, I've never had to pay near that much.
Okay, so let's say I want to find out who paid for President Bush's flight suit and his stunt where he landed on the aircraft carrier to declare the mission accomplished in Iraq. I put a letter in the mail to the FOIA administrator at the Department of Defense and say I'm willing to pay $150 for the information. Please send me the appropriate documentation. That's it?
Oh, that's pretty much it. Yeah. The only thing is when you write the letter, you have to say, you know, something along the lines of this is a request under the Freedom of Information Act. And after that, just tell them what you want. It also helps if you tell them whether or not you're an independent researcher or a member of the media or something like that, just so that they can assess fees. And if you're a member of the media, it actually all fees are supposed to be waived. You know, you don't have to tell them anything about why you want this material. And by law, they're not allowed to ask you that either.
All right, Russ. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Russ Kick is editor and publisher of TheMemoryHole.org.
Up next, efforts to control content on PBS and cable and how America got left in the dust on the information highway.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For many years, conservative Republicans have complained about a liberal tilt in public broadcasting and have attempted at various times to deal with the problem by cutting federal funds to public radio and TV. This week, the New York Times reported that the battle is being waged yet again at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The 9-member board appointed by the president is the conduit through which tax dollars flow to public radio and TV stations and to PBS itself. The chairman of the CPB board is Republican Kenneth Tomlinson. He acknowledged to the Times that he hired consultants to document a leftist tilt he perceived in the PBS program Now with Bill Moyers, and that he helped get a correspondingly right-tilted show, the Journal Editorial Report, on the air. The Times also reported that Tomlinson worked with White House political adviser Karl Rove to help kill a legislative effort that would have made it more difficult to politically stack the CPB board. Tomlinson told us he is not politicizing public broadcasting, but rather balancing programming to serve more Americans.
I don't want to achieve balance by taking programs that are the favorites of good liberals off the air. I want to make sure that when we have programs that tilt left, we also have some programs that tilt right so the viewer can make up his or her own mind. A couple of years ago, the primary complaints were about the Bill Moyers show, and my proposal for that was to get other shows that, as I say, tilted right. Today you have a 30-minute Now program in many markets, and you have a 30-minute Wall Street Journal program in many markets. People can pick and choose. That's balance.
Ken, aren't you confusing liberalism with journalism? The two have a lot in common: suspicion of authority, sympathy for the little guy, the instinct to reform, and so on. Of course, Frontline and Now with Bill Moyers will question the establishment, will question power, no matter who is in power, whichever party. That isn't ideological bias, Ken. It's journalism.
I beg to differ. I have no quarrel at all with Frontline. I did have a quarrel with the politics of the Moyers show. But did I want it removed? Absolutely not. The issue, why can't you accept, let's have one program, if it's tilted one way, let's make sure we have other programs tilted the other way.
Well, I can answer that question. Isn't there a danger of creating a self-fulfilling prophecy by trying to artificially balance it with explicitly political material? Aren't you, in fact, playing politics with something that was not a political matter to begin with?
I simply disagree with you, and I think you're the one playing politics by the way you're framing the question. I am for good investigative journalism in the tradition of Frontline and 60 Minutes. I have no objection to politically tilted programs. Will there be times when reporting supersedes the issue of balance? Absolutely. The public understands what it is. People here in Washington understand what it is. They can see the tilt. And what I want to do is I want people not to regard public broadcasting as a voice of one particular ideological side in this country. I want them to hear the voices of America, the diverse voices of America on public television.
Did you not do opinion research and discover that, on the whole, the public believes that they're getting a pretty even shake from their public broadcasting?
The opinion research reveals that the public has a very positive attitude toward public broadcasting, but that attitude should be even higher. Public television now is in financial trouble. We are trying to find ways to firm up the foundation of public broadcasting, or public broadcasting could be in jeopardy.
Isn't it a dangerous crossing of lines of authority for CPB, which is supposed to be a funding organization for public broadcasting, to explicitly interfere in editorial decisions by public broadcasting?
What we do is from the bloody pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt said. And I also made sure that in the last 2 years, those discussions were inside public broadcasting, because I did not choose to bring controversy to public broadcasting over the issue of balance. Others did. And so when you create a New York Times story, which ran on us earlier this week, you create the controversy. And on a show like this, I want to come back and discuss it. I'm not looking for political gain. My role in this is to encourage support for what we're doing in public broadcasting.
Did you speak to the president when you were appointed?
I've spoken to the president in the past, but I've never spoken to anyone in the White House about these issues.
Is it your assertion that the CPB is not being politicized by the White House?
Well, of course it's not being politicized by the White House.
According to the New York Times story that appeared recently, you worked with Karl Rove, the president's political advisor, to help change the terms by which CPB board seats would be filled.
Let me clear up that error in the Times. Two leaders of public broadcasting came to me and suggested that Karl Rove's office would be supporting their effort to effectively pack the CPB board. I asked Karl Rove, are you all going to be supporting this? And he said, no, end of involvement.
It's well known that Republicans in the House periodically have attempted to cut funding or entirely defund public broadcasting. Is there some sort of threat implicit here that, you know, either put on the right-wing shows or watch out this time, we're really going to pull the plug?
You know, in recent years, we've had very good Republican support for public broadcasting. I don't think you've heard any serious call in recent years from any point on the political spectrum to do anything to significantly reduce funding for public broadcasting. I just think that my course of action, in conjunction with common sense, will encourage greater support for public broadcasting.
The Bush administration is talking about a $60 million cut. Is that apolitical in nature?
We have some budgetary work to do, but we live in very tough budgetary times. We have a lot of people going for that federal treasury, and I want there to be a consensus in this country that public broadcasting should get its share.
I very much appreciate your spending the time with us.
Thanks.
Kenneth Tomlinson is chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Ever since the Janet Jackson boob incident, calls to rid TV of indecency have been getting more common, to the point that some lawmakers are even hinting at regulating cable. Programmers have rallied in response to the widening indecency crackdown. This week, a coalition of groups backed by NBC, Viacom, and News Corp launched TV Watch, which opposes new content legislation. And the group has released a new poll suggesting that a vast majority of Americans favor personal responsibility over more government regulation. Adam Thier is a member of TV Watch and director of the Center for Digital Media Freedom. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to begin by asking you to review the arguments for regulation, because they aren't necessarily uncompelling.
The argument is that cable and satellite have essentially become more popular in our society. And because they are that popular, they are more pervasive. And once they become pervasive, it triggers a different type of constitutional analysis first found in the famous 1978 Pacifica case that governed broadcasting, that said because broadcasting was a uniquely pervasive influence in our lives and uniquely accessible to children, that essentially the government could treat broadcasters differently than any other type of media outlet. And therefore, the argument would be, why not treat cable and satellite like that in light of the fact that they are now just as popular, if not more popular, than broadcast television, radio, and the like?
You say there's a difference between popularity and pervasiveness. What do you mean?
Well, the argument that popularity equals pervasiveness is a troubling one. In the specific case of cable and satellite, when 85% of American households decide to voluntarily bring these subscription-based services into the home, that should count for something. After all, these services aren't free. Once parents do that, they should bear a great deal of responsibility over what their children see or hear with that media. And that really is what this debate comes down to, a question of, is this pervasiveness rationale going to dominate, or is parental and personal responsibility going to dominate?
Everybody wants to protect children. Nobody can argue against that, but virtually all the well-meaning legislation passed to date to limit their exposure to smut on the internet has been overturned by the courts, has it not?
That's correct. And that's because the courts have said, look, with these new technologies, parents have all new sorts of controls that empower them to screen or filter things that they don't want their children to see. And it's even more the case when it comes to cable and satellite television. Parents have various types of set-top boxes with password protections in them. They have the ability to use the V-chip. And then, of course, you have these new technologies like TiVos or personal video recorders, which give you the ability, as I do with my children, to create your own personal library of programming that you think is appropriate for your kids, and then only let them watch that. So these are sort of redundant sets of controls now available to parents that the courts would look at and say, this is a quote-unquote less restrictive means of filtering programs than the more clunky, ham-handed types of government censorship we've seen for broadcasting.
All right, well, let's talk about that ham-handed kind of censorship. Why has broadcast been exempted from First Amendment protection?
One argument is that it's because it's licensed. The spectrum is doled out by the federal government, and only so many people get to use it. A second argument is that it's scarce, and therefore, because only so many people can use it, different standards should apply. And then the third argument is the pervasiveness argument, the notion that it's so utterly ubiquitous and accessible to all Americans, especially children, that it should be regulated differently.
Well, given the fact that cable does not take place over the government-owned and controlled broadcast spectrum, even if some legislation is passed in Congress, is there a chance in hell that it will survive even the first court challenge?
I think there's a very slim chance that cable would be found to be under the government's control in terms of censorship or indecency regulations. The best argument in favor of regulating broadcast differently has always been that, quote unquote, it's an invader into the home. The idea that broadcast signals come right through the walls of your house and are played right over your television or radio set. Well, you know, even that argument's been a little fuzzy because those radios and televisions just didn't have legs and magically walk into our homes or cars. We put them there or accepted the fact that they were there. But you apply that logic, the invader in the home logic, to cable and satellite or any other new media technology, and it completely breaks down. Moreover, there are all these new technological controls that enable us to privately censor or filter what we don't want our children to see or hear. And that, I think the courts will say, is the end of the story. But here's the really interesting question. Would the courts go one step further and say that this entire indecency regime or all of the old standards that have applied to broadcasting now are gone as well? Precisely because we live in a world of media convergence, where we can get the same types of programming increasingly over cable, over satellite, over a cell phone, and over broadcast television and radio, the courts might look at this and say, we need to think about media comprehensively as a playing field that's been leveled, and we need to therefore level the law accordingly and treat all media equally in the eyes of the First Amendment.
Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Thier is Senior Fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation and Director of its Center for Digital Media Freedom.
When the future finally catches up with technology, we'll all carry devices that offer anytime, anywhere connections to the Internet, fast, cheap, and reliable. And not just because it's fun, writes Thomas Blea in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, but because high-speed Internet access is an economic necessity. Think of it this way. When Eisenhower established an interstate highway system 50 years ago, it wasn't for joyrides, but to move goods around the country faster. Blea says America has blown its lead in the new economy. We have a broadband gap.
We are somewhere between being on a gravel road, which would be dial-up, and an asphalt road, a newly paved gravel road, which I call basic broadband. The basic broadband is about 25 times faster than the dial-up. But in Japan, in Korea, and urban China, they are now on high-speed broadband, which I could liken to two-lane state highways, which are 15 times faster than we are currently using, our asphalt road. And increasingly, they have millions of people on ultra-high-speed fiber highways, or our interstate highway system, which is four times faster still. And at that top speed, you can download a song in a few seconds, and you can download a full-length movie in less than 5 minutes.
So why don't you tell me, first of all, what the E-Japan strategy has been, and then tell me what the Bush administration, as you've written, seems to have done wrong.
In Japan, they were well behind at the end of 2000. They appointed a high-profile commission headed by the Sony chairman, Ide, that came up with a very bold proposal that Japan become the world's leading internet nation in 5 years' time. They took the strategy into the prime minister's office. They laid out some very ambitious goals for broadband, and they have funded them, and they have followed through. In less than 2 years and a half, for example, they went ahead of us in the percentage of with broadband access. Now, what did we do wrong? The top levels of the Bush administration are simply uninterested in this issue. The Federal Communications Commission produced somewhat unpredictable and difficult to interpret decisions. So basically, we've had about 4 years of drift. And unless we have some more direction from the government, I would argue we're going to drift for quite a while longer.
It sounds like the Japanese strategy was simply to combine the forces of business and government and to look ahead. What steps do you think the FCC or the cabinet should have taken during that time?
They should have continued with a competition policy that was begun in the Clinton-Gore years by the FCC.
What does that mean?
Well, the Clinton-Gore FCC basically permitted any qualified competitor to have access to the telephone lines that go into our homes. But the telephone companies resisted that mightily in the courts and on the Hill. And after about 3 years of the Bush administration, that competition policy has basically died. And we are now stuck with another approach, which will pit the telephone companies, DSL, against the cable companies. And they hope the power line companies will come in and wireless companies will also join the competition.
You know, Tom, you're probably aware that The Economist called you a techno-alarmist. They say the situation isn't nearly as bad as you claim. For example, America, by virtue of its size, will naturally take more time to wire up than, say, Denmark or South Korea. But per capita, our broadband penetration is in fact above average, right?
It is above average, but it's also the quality of the broadband. Our broadband is among the slowest, most expensive, and least reliable in the advanced industrialized countries. That's why I likened it to an asphalt road. Other countries, for about half the price, have state highways, and for the price that we pay for our asphalt roads, they have interstate highways. And I believe, and the economist disagrees, that at each of those stages, there will be new content possibilities, there will be new services. You're dealing with a qualitatively different kind of communication.
The economist also disputes your assertion of the risk that America will incur if it doesn't catch up soon.
Yeah, I think they're simply wrong in that. You know, the Clinton-Gore administration in its final economic report chalked up fully one-third of the growth in the American economy between 1995 and 2000 to information technology. It's hard to know, but surely there is hundreds of billions of dollars at stake over the next several years, and there are hundreds of thousands of jobs at stake.
And so when people say you're the prophet of techno-doom, you just say...
On the contrary, I'm trying to get our country moving. If we have to have an analogy rather than a religious one, I would choose Paul Revere.
Tom, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Tom Blaya, the recipient of an Abe Fellowship, is finishing his book on the race for Internet leadership. Its working title is Down to the Wire.
Coming up, CNN and the Runaway Bride, a match made in tabloid heaven.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Melville Charitable Trust Foundation, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, many media watchers complained about news they can't use, about a certain runaway bride. When Jennifer Wilbanks got cold feet, she made tabloid headlines and left tracks all over the cable news channels, including CNN, the network that promised more and more rigorous journalism after Jonathan Klein took over as president last December. And so we called him up. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So shortly after you took over as president of CNN, you said you wanted fewer, quote, head-butting festivals of the crossfire variety and more reporting of the news. So you're now 5 months into the job, still committed to that strategy?
Oh, yeah, more than ever. You know, the public are bombarded with headlines, so they have a sense that they know what's going on. But in fact, there's a huge gap between awareness and real knowledge. And there aren't too many outlets that will close that gap. Well, that's what we aspire to do at CNN. We've got the resources to do it. We've got people all over the world. The real key is execution, you know, living up to it and resisting the urge to stray.
Now, you were quoted as saying that CNN will do more roll-up-your-sleeves storytelling with provocative, character-driven narratives. Give me a sense of the kind of stories you're talking about.
Oh, we've done all sorts of things. Anderson Cooper went to Lebanon and Syria to really chart the birth of democracy there. Frank Sesno went to Germany to report a story on Hitler's secret family history. We had six different reporters spend a couple of months looking into teen driving and why statistics actually have improved as far as safety in the past year. And so we're running the gamut.
Well, let's talk about the other end of that gamut then. Let's talk about Monday, May 2nd. CNN Daybreak, The Rundown had Runaway Bride, American Morning, Runaway Bride could face criminal charges. Live from CNN, Runaway Bride back home, Crossfire, should Runaway Bride face charges. Anderson Cooper, Paula Zahn, Larry King, Aaron Brown, all of them devoted at least part of their program to Jennifer Wilbanks, the Runaway Bride. And Jonathan, I have to ask you, does this fit into the roll-up-your-sleeves storytelling that you have in mind?
Well, sure. I mean, the New York Times covered the Runaway Bride, too, and I'm sure I heard a story about it on NPR.
It was way buried in the New York Times.
Well, we can quibble over degree, but what you will see more and more of is CNN focusing its resources on any given day around a few big stories while we continue to cover everything else as well. But one of our problems was before we were spread too thin. We would do a little bit about a lot of things. But none of it was very satisfying. It was all very headliney and surfacey. So instead, we're going to, on a regular basis, choose a story that we think is important or interesting. We were the first to throw all of our resources against the Schiavo story, and we really put that story on the national agenda. And then we rolled up our sleeves and went down to Pinellas Park, and we went out to Tallahassee and got exclusive interviews with Jeb Bush.
We can quibble about the importance of the Schiavo case. I don't want to, but I don't think it's a quibble to talk about the degree of coverage and the fact that there was some coverage of the Runaway Bride in the New York Times in a discrete story or two is quite different from what CNN did. A few years ago, we spoke to one of your predecessors, Walter Isaacson. He said some things in 2001 very similar to what you're saying now, more news and reporting, less shouting and soap operas. In fact, Bob read him a list almost identical to the one I just read you with the words Chandra Levy substituting for Runaway Bride. And
right.
Is the lesson here that cable news simply operates at a level of inertia and entropy that no one can change, that you throw blanket coverage at a story that really doesn't merit it?
No, if you were listening to me, Brooke, you would have heard me say that on some days, that story that we decide to focus on will be the Runaway Bride. On other days, the story will be the spread of democracy in Lebanon. We looked around. We didn't see any other network anchor in Lebanon. And then we went to Syria, and we didn't find any network anchor there either. Now, you could criticize us for covering that story too heavily as well.
But are you saying that CNN's coverage of the Runaway Bride was an appropriate amount of coverage?
Oh, for sure. It was a fascinating story that had left a lot of questions unanswered. What drove her to this? Is this a crime?
Jonathan, people disappear every day. It didn't become a story in the eyes of viewers until this seemed to take center stage on all the cable networks.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm a big believer that there's nothing innate about the medium that says it must take one road or another. It doesn't have to be high road or low road. And so sometimes it's going to be Lebanon and Syria and Baghdad, and sometimes it's going to be the 30th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. Sometimes it's going to be the Runaway Bride.
It seems to me that for the purposes of our discussion, you keep equating stories like Lebanon, which need no justification, with a weird little blip of a story like The Runaway Bride, which actually does need some justification.
Well, and yet, that's possibly a pretty elitist thing to say, because I don't know that you can say that one story needs justification and one doesn't. Who are you to argue with the people who flock to watch one story and not the other? The reason that I keep bringing up Lebanon and Syria is because our coverage of those stories and the tsunami and the Iraq elections are as indicative of the kind of work and journalism that CNN ought to be known for as one day in which we covered the Runaway Bride. I mean, I'm sorry that you didn't like it, but if you like the rest of what we've done for the last 5 months, then I feel okay. Because I think over time we prove out and are getting even better at being worth the attention of our audience. And yeah, sometimes they'll disagree with it. Sometimes you personally will disagree with it, Brooke, but you know, maybe you need to get more in sync with what viewers out there want to know about.
and you didn't cover it because you were afraid people would turn to Fox.
No, we really, and I'm glad you bring that up, because it's a fair question. Yes, we're in a competitive environment, but one area we've been very successful in is making our own decisions and not worrying what those other guys are doing. They do talk radio, and we do reporting. We lose far more people to the broadcast networks and to the internet than we do to Fox News.
Jonathan Klein, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Klein is the president of CNN.
Cable news channels populate the airwaves with pundits. Among them are print and radio reporters pulled from their word processors or microphones and parked in front of the cameras. But now there's help for the reporters, that is, not for the audience. One Washington public relations firm is offering journalists with little or no TV experience some training for their star turns as pundits. We sent our own John Solomon to see what they could do with him.
I was once a promising TV pundit prodigy. At age 13, I appeared as an imposter on To Tell the Truth, the old game show where contestants who are not experts try to play one on TV. In my episode, I pretended to be a hot young painter.
Number two, what is your name, please?
My name is Volodek Kuss. This black and white painting...
And to know enough about art to fool the celebrity panel, including Nipsey Russell.
All right, number two, do you do all abstracts or do you do some representational things?
I'm an abstract painter, but occasionally I'll do things that follow up a,
In the midst of my abstract answer, Nipsey jumped in and rescued me.
I see. Who is your favorite painter, number two? I'm still talking with
Jackson Pollock.
I see.
I didn't convince Nipsey, but I did get panelist Bill Cullen's vote.
That is number two. I think number two has it very well thought out. And, that's not
and host Gary Moore seemed to hint at a limitless TV future.
The rest of us, too. What is your real name? What do you do?
My name is John Solomon.
You're a good contestant, I'll tell you that. And the same goes.
However, it took me more than two decades to return to the tube. Fox News Channel invited me to talk about an article I had written for USA Today on a potential baseball strike.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Neil Cavuto, and this is Your World. My next guest says that a strike would be a good thing. He's John Solomon. He's a sports journalist right here in New York.
I say the sport needs a strike. Right now, they're negotiating really a very stopgap situation.
I was not invited back. So when the folks here at On the Media signed me to do a story about a Washington, D.C. company that was training journalists for TV punditry, I saw it as an opportunity to jumpstart a career that had peaked just before my bar mitzvah. On the train down, I heard someone a few seats back speaking on his cell phone. He said, "Well, Tina heard me talk about Enron at a dinner party and asked me to be on the show next week." Was there a real-life TV pundit aboard my train? I turned around. It was Joe Nocera, a longtime print journalist currently at the New York Times. Nocera moved into radio as a commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday and now is a regular on TV. He tried to put me at ease about my own potential transition.
When people ask me why I'm so relaxed on television, I just say it's simple. The stakes are so low. What is there to be worried about? For so many of these shows, the audiences are pretty small because the knowledge required is so minimal, this isn't always true, but a lot of times the hosts are idiots.
No, Sarah quickly added that he wasn't referring to Tina.
Ladies and gentlemen, next station, stop over Union Station, Washington, D.C.,
As Nocera and I walked off the train, the first person I saw was an old college acquaintance. I hadn't seen him since he was on TV as a legal pundit during the Clinton impeachment. He has since returned to real law and didn't want to be interviewed. As I continued through the station, I recognized yet another face from cable. Joe Watkins, a conservative co-host of CNN's Crossfire.
Should you feel somewhat bad if you haven't been on TV and you're in Union Station?
They're everywhere.
A few weeks before, I had asked Watkins co-host Paul Begala whether a class at Pundit U could make a good Crossfire guest out of me.
No. Maybe you either got it or you don't.
If I had it, I would find it in the 1,000-square-foot mock TV studio located at the downtown offices of Corvus Communications. I was welcomed by my punditry professor, Rich Masters, a gregarious 42-year-old former rock disc jockey, local television reporter, and U.S. Senate aide, Natalie attired in a tan pinstripe suit and ostrich skin boots. Masters sat me down on a chair about 10 feet in front of a video camera. He fit me with an earpiece.
Yeah, this is a baseline. So feel free to screw it up so that you look really great when it's all done.
He then disappeared into a sound booth. Suddenly, Klieg lights clicked on from above. The next thing I heard was...
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Late Edition. John Solomon, will Tom DeLay survive?
I think Majority Leader DeLay's days are in fact numbered, and
I was in a spiral, and Nipsey Russell wasn't around to bail me out.
He'll be gone. He's doing as well as I am doing right now.
Well, I guess only time will tell. Thank you again, John Solomon, NPR, for joining us.
The Klieg lights were switched off.
That just to show that was for the baseline, to really...
Thank you, very perfect.
Next, Masters gave a PowerPoint presentation with some pundit do's and don'ts. Sample do. Prepare and practice in advance. For each likely question, create what Masters calls message diamonds, which should include your main point, then a lively anecdote, and finally the same point repeated in a slightly different form. Sample don't, a pre-show cocktail. Masters made that mistake himself and ended up inventing a new word, authentication, live on Fox's Hannity and Combs. Now briefed and still sober, I return for another appearance on fake live TV.
Welcome back to MSNBC. Gun owners have long complained that they don't get a fair break from the media. National Public Radio's John Solomon went into the field to find out what the problem was.
After I finished explaining what the problem was, we went into a conference room to replay the tape so Masters could show me, on a huge plasma TV screen, what my problems were.
After the election, there was a big hue and cry about the fact that the blue state media didn't understand the red states. And one of the big issues was guns.
Masters froze the frame.
A couple things. Energy a little bit. As you can see from this, there's a need for makeup.
The plasma TV had also apparently sucked all the blood out of my alarmingly peaked face.
Because you can't control the sweating thing, but you can see you got a little bit of a 5 o'clock shadow. But you have a little bit of a head bobble thing, a kind of a little bobble head thing, but not as bad as I've seen a lot of folks have it.
He turned back to the screen and pressed the remote.
I think a lot of people view gun owners as people who are unsafe. But in fact, when you're around gun owners, you find that they're as concerned with safety because, in fact, they're going out hunting with their relatives or their family. And in fact, safety is paramount to them. So
I told Masters that at NPR we got a $10 bonus every time we use the phrase, in fact.
No, mine's clearly, 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 clearly. I say clearly 1,000 times in a 2-minute deal. Word crutches, there's nothing wrong with them.
He said it gives you time to get ready for what you'll say next. But in fact, that was my biggest problem.
I realized that every time I added more, I got myself in trouble. Is that a common thing where you kind of hit it nicely, you get a nice little double, and you go for the home run, and you start wandering, and you say, why did I... added. I was so doing well, and then or decently.
That's absolutely common. Television ain't splitting the atom. You want to get in and out. It's laser surgery, baby. You get in and out, and you just keep it as tight as you possibly can. When you feel that need to take it one step further, that's when you're going to end up rambling.
Master said I also needed to bring some of my personality on the air with me.
Oh, yeah. Sitting here, you've got just this great energy. Engaging talk, and watch this. It drops off. Your energy level drops off a full quarter, if not more than that.
Because, in fact, there is much more common ground on this issue than has been portrayed in the press.
Thank you, John Solomon, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
The screen went black, and I awaited my final evaluation. Was I any good at this TV thing? I used to be.
You're a good contestant, I'll tell you that. Tell you that.
So I was excited when Masters asked if he could use part of my performance as a model to show future students, until I found out what part.
Majority Leader DeLay's days are in fact numbered, and
That would be a brain freeze. That's what we call the Solomon.
Still, Masters saw enough potential in the full Solomon that he offered to pitch me to talk show bookers. It turned out I didn't need his help to get my next TV interview about another type of delay. The following morning, I was waiting in Union Station because brake problems had caused rail cancellations all along the Northeast Corridor. And a local television reporter was looking for reaction.
Live from the area's leading news station, this is News 4 at 4.
Amtrak's Acela trains are still out of service. Some passengers at Union Station this morning had to switch to regional service, which makes more stops.
So I upped my energy, answered concisely in message diamonds, and I had just shaved. Soon, I would no longer be the only one in Union Station not recognizable from TV. But alas, my interview didn't make it on air. A few days later, I got an email from Joe Nocera informing me that he too got bumped. At the last minute, Tina Brown had decided to switch the panel discussion from Enron to Michael Jackson. Well, Joe, I guess that's television. For On the Media, at least for now.
My name is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.